Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last week, Oklahoma tried to execute convicted killer Clayton Lockett, but they botched the execution, leaving him writhing in apparent pain for more than 40 minutes. The president and the world responded. Now the state of Oklahoma is investigating what went wrong. President Obama has ordered a Justice Department review, and the United Nations says it may have violated international law. With more than 3,000 prisoners on death row, questions persist about the varying drug cocktails used to execute the nation's inmates. This hour on Point, the death penalty in the United States today. You can join us on air or online. How should we respond to the botched execution in Oklahoma? When should the death penalty be used, and how should it be administered? Is it the best form of justice for our most violent criminals? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is Devlin Barrett. Devlin is Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Devlin, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for being with us. Friday, President Obama called the botched execution of Clayton Lockett deeply troubling, while he also stressed that he still supports the death penalty in some cases. Here's what the president said at a news conference in the Rose Garden Friday.
What happened in Oklahoma is deeply troubling. The individual who was subject to the death penalty had committed heinous crimes, terrible crimes. And I've said in the past that there are certain circumstances in which a crime is so terrible that the application of the death penalty may be appropriate.
Devlin, you heard him call it deeply troubling, and he has ordered the Justice Department to begin a review. What is the Justice Department actually going to review?
Well, they're going to review the procedures and protocols that the states use in carrying out executions. And the backstory here is that the Justice Department has been conducting such review of its own federal death penalty procedures for a few years. And essentially, based on the president's direction, they're now going to expand that and also look at what the states are doing and try and come up with some sort of best practice or most appropriate way to administer the death penalty.
Is there any current federal oversight of executions or even a national standard that states are supposed to follow?
No, it's and this is one of the sort of oddities of the federal review that the president's direction has basically created, which is that the Department of Justice doesn't really have control over how states execute people, never has. The best they could do, really, realistically, is to offer some suggestions and best practices for executing people. And it's not clear, frankly, that states would necessarily follow whatever direction the federal government gave them when we get to that point.
Hmm. Is there anything that the president can do in a national way by executive action, or what kind of power, if any, does the attorney general have to exact these standards, enforce these standards in states?
Well, I think this most powerful way to do it would be to set an example. I mean, you know, this whole issue of the drug cocktail, the three-drug cocktail that is increasingly difficult for states and any executioner to get, and all of these different jurisdictions scrambling to come up with their own different versions of the drug cocktail because it's no longer available, has led us up to this point where you saw what happened in Oklahoma. And there's these huge fights now over what is or isn't an appropriate drug to administer to patients. And it's sort of a modern-day version. If you think back about how executions used to be done in this country, it's basically a modern-day argument over, you know, what the hangman's rope should be made of. Hmm. You know, it's you're arguing about the mechanics because that is what's left to argue about.
So is it – will you take us back for a minute first? Mm-hmm. explain to us why there is this debate over which drug should be used in the cocktail and why some of them are no longer available.
Right. So the sequence of here is that in 2007, the Supreme Court says what was then thought of as the standard three-drug cocktail is constitutional in administering the death penalty. What happens after that is in 2011, the U.S. company that supplies one of the major ingredients of that cocktail says, you know what, we're not going to do this anymore. We don't feel right being in this business. That suddenly puts pressure on a European manufacturer who then decides, you know what, actually, we have no interest in being in this business. We're a drug company. We're here to help people. We do not want to be part of killing people. And so when those two companies bow out and no one else steps up, let's say, no other major manufacturer steps up and sort of starts selling these products knowing what they're going to be used for, you then have this sort of free-for-all, maybe a little strong, but it's a little bit of a free-for-all among the states of, well, what do we get and where do we get it to keep killing people? And so you've got things like compounding pharmacies, where they essentially mix up drugs from the base components, and you've also got this new fight that's different iterations of the same fight, which is inmates and their death row inmates and their lawyers fighting to find out what specific drugs the states are using now, because they want to challenge the use of those drugs as possibly cruel or possibly unusual. But because the states are so worried about still having access to drugs, given what has happened, they don't want to tell anyone what drugs they're getting or who they're getting it from. And so now you've got this whole system, this whole argument now revolves around what drugs are okay to administer to death row inmates at the moment of their execution. And I suspect that at some point we're going to get to a point where someone's going to say, well, we should just give them overdoses of barbiturates or morphine or things like that. You know, there are, frankly, simpler, I hate to say it sounds callous, but there are simpler ways to kill people than a three-drug cocktail. And I'm curious in my own mind if that's where we're headed.
And that rule, if it were to come to pass, a national standard for what the cocktail should look like, it would have to be passed as a federal law, wouldn't it? I mean, there's nothing really in the executive branch's power that allows them to enforce that on the states.
Well, they can enforce it on the states, correct. And it would be an interesting legal fight if Congress, for example, tried to pass a law that mandated to states what they can do. I think the more likely scenario, assuming you get a real, concrete example from this Justice Department review. Remember, this review has been going on for 3 years, so it hasn't exactly been, a lightning fast result yet. I think what you were more likely scenario to see is that the Justice Department would say, okay, we believe this drug is the best one to use, or this combination of drugs is the best one to use, and we would recommend that to all the states. And then what will happen is, because this is how death penalty issues work, is that some inmates' lawyers will immediately challenge that, and then the courts will decide whether the Justice Department is right in its decision on this drug or that drug.
And then that would create the new standard if the court weighed in, is what
presumably,
you're saying.
Presumably, yeah. And you'd have to see it play out in a bunch of different states. I mean, there is no sort of uniformity to the death penalty process now. And I frankly don't expect there to become one, even as this process goes forward and even as Oklahoma does its review. I would be surprised if at the end of this what you see is a nationwide standard, because the differences between the states and how they view this issue is pretty vast.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Devlin Barrett. That was a very useful debrief with the headline that there is no uniformity in the process of death penalty across the U.S. Devlin, thank you.
Thank you.
Devlin is the Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And joining us now is Ziva Branstetter. She's enterprise editor at Tulsa World, and she witnessed the execution of Clayton Lockett last week. Ziva Branstetter, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. This is a difficult conversation. I'd like to ask you, you watched the execution. If you could just start by telling us what you saw.
Yes, so the execution started at 6:23 p.m. About 10 minutes into the execution, the doctor pronounced the inmate unconscious. And then at about 13 minutes into the execution, the inmate began mumbling, rolling his head side to side, and began about 3 minutes of a violent reaction. His body was bucking like he was trying to get up. He raised his head and shoulders off the gurney. He was clenching his teeth and grimacing. He was clearly in pain. After that point of 3 minutes of that reaction, the warden who was present in the death chamber ordered the blinds closed.
And a couple of questions. When he was bucking and writhing, you said he said some words. I've heard it report. Yeah, go ahead. What did he say?
Correct. So there were 12 media witnesses present. I heard him clearly say, man, like he was just exclaiming that he was in pain. Other witnesses heard him say, something's wrong. So, you know, among the witnesses, we clearly heard him say, indicate that he was in pain, that he felt something was wrong with the execution.
Now, have you've seen an execution before? Was this different from the ones you witnessed in the past?
Yes, this is the fourth execution I've witnessed. This was vastly different than the executions I've witnessed in the past. The previous three, the inmate was pronounced dead within 6 to 8 minutes with absolutely no reaction of this kind. They basically go to sleep, the color drains from their face, and it's over.
When they first began the execution, did they make an announcement, officials, to tell you what they were going to do?
No, I mean, you pretty much... You know, the media witnesses in the room know how this works. It did start late. Several of us who'd witnessed other executions knew that they were late. It started at 6:23. Normally, they start right after 6. And then the witness had no last words. Then they say, let the execution begin. And it just, the whole thing took longer. It was different. It took a long time to become declared unconscious. It just never seemed like it went as planned.
And when they pulled the blinds, did they explain?
The warden said, we're going to temporarily close the blinds. They didn't explain, but it was clear to us that because of this violent reaction, they needed to check the IV. They later explained, the DOC director later explained it was for the inmate's privacy. The IV vein, unknown to us, had been inserted in a femoral vein in his leg. I suppose they're...
We'll discuss this. Let me just interrupt you for a moment. We'll discuss this more. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing capital punishment in the United States after last week's botched execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma. And we're talking now with Ziva Brandstetter, enterprise editor at the Tulsa World. She witnessed the execution of Clayton Lockett. And Ziva, before we took a break, you were describing the scene when they pulled the blinds as you were witnessing it, and you were no longer able to see what was happening in the execution chamber. Can you tell us what was the reaction among the media observers in your room when this happened?
Well, we were all shocked. We were... surprised that this that the blinds were closed. We were upset that we were not able to finish our job of witnessing the execution. That was my main emotion, was that I felt like I was being deprived of a chance to tell the public how this was being carried out, whether you support the death penalty or not. That was the purpose we were there for.
Hmm. Now, I don't want to forget the victim in all this. It was 19-year-old Stephanie Niemann, murdered in 1999. It was her killing that Clayton Lockett was put to death for. Will you remind us of his crime? What did he do?
Yes, he abducted Stephanie, two of her adult friends, and a baby. He had two accomplices. It was during a home invasion robbery. There was some relationship between Mr. Lockett and one of the adults who were kidnapped. They were taken out to a country road. For some reason, Stephanie was selected to be the one who died in this crime. There's some discussion that she just refused to back down to this guy, and for whatever reason, he shot her twice and ordered an accomplice to bury her in a shallow grave, and despite the fact that she was still breathing.
And in this case, there's no question about his guilt. He confessed, correct?
No question at all. He was not contesting his guilt.
Now, there's a second convict in a different crime, Charles Warner, who was also supposed to be executed that night in Oklahoma. The two crimes not related. But his execution has been put on hold. What's the status of Charles Warner?
Correct. So Charles Warner's execution was stayed until May 13th by the governor following the botched execution of Clayton Lockett. The governor says that she has the authority to request a 60-day stay while the state revises its death penalty protocols. However, his execution date is still set for May 13th. So yesterday, his attorneys asked our Court of Criminal Appeals for an indefinite stay because they said they had received no assurances that there would be a stay requested by the governor or by the attorney general.
And the governor is now doing a review in the state as well. It's separate from the attorney general's review. What does that involve?
She has appointed her Commissioner of Public Safety, Michael Thompson, to lead an investigation. Some critics have pointed out that Michael Thompson oversees the Department of Corrections as an agency head, that he also used to work for the Department of Corrections, and that he was a witness to the execution. So there's some question about his independence. She has also ordered that an autopsy be done in Dallas so that it's not done here, that it has an independent process.
Okay. And how long is that supposed to take?
That's supposed to take 8 to 12 weeks. We expect the investigation and the autopsy process could take several months.
And finally, what kind of reaction has all of this provoked in Oklahoma? It's creating a national discussion, but I'm wondering, is it as fierce there or more fierce?
It's more fierce. I mean, it's created a tremendous debate. Oklahoma is a conservative state that does support the death penalty in general. The governor has said that the citizens of the state do not have blood on their hands. The family of the inmate has said that the state committed another homicide. The victim's family has not spoken out. There's quite a bit of calls and emails and reaction that we're getting here at the newspaper. So it has created a tremendous debate within our state.
Ziva Brandstetter, enterprise editor at the Tulsa World. Ziva, witnessing an execution is one of the hardest jobs I think a member of the press can do. So thank you for doing it for all of us and reporting to us. And thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Jessica.
That was Ziva Brandstetter of the Tulsa World. I'd now like to introduce two other big voices in the capital punishment debate. Joining us now from New York is Peter Neufeld, co-director of the Innocence Project. It's a nonprofit legal organization that works to exonerate wrongly convicted people. He is a longtime anti-death penalty advocate. Peter, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jessica.
Hello. And from Washington is John Malcolm, director of the Legal Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. John supports the death penalty, and I think we'll have a lively debate between the two of you. John Malcolm, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me on.
Hi. So, Peter, I'd like to start with you. Clayton Lockett said that he did it. He is a confessed killer, so the question of his guilt would seem isn't in doubt. I want to listen to a moment, if we could, of Clayton Lockett's recorded confession from 15 years ago. In this confession, he describes how he, along with two other men, buried 19-year-old Stephanie Neiman alive after shooting her twice.
I ran back up and said, she's not dead, she's still breathing and kicking and moving. I said, man, I done shot her twice. I said, I'm not finna shoot her again. They said, she not dead. I said, well, go get the gun and shoot her. And they was like, nah. Sean said, I'll just bury her. He said, I don't think she can move, but she got up and tried to run. So he started throwing dirt over her. And I could see her coughing. I could see the dirt coming in the air as she was coughing. So he kept on putting dirt over and everything until I couldn't hear her coughing and choking anymore.
He kept putting dirt on her until I couldn't hear her coughing and choking anymore. It's a heinous crime. His innocence is not in doubt. So, Peter, what are the arguments against the death penalty when there's no question about the guilt?
Well, you know, people are unclear as to when there is no question about the guilt. We've had 18 exonerations of people who are on death row where there was no question about their guilt, where their convictions have been affirmed by every court, both in the state appellate system and in the federal system. And then only, you know, shortly before they were to be executed, did serendipitously DNA exclusions exonerate them. So, you know, you have these two different perspectives here. And a lot of people in this country know that there's a real danger of executing innocent people, believe that it is most likely we've already executed innocent people, and think that that's a completely inappropriate situation, that it would be much better to have life without parole for those people, that that's more than an adequate punishment, particularly since there's no compelling evidence that capital punishment has been demonstrated to be a deterrent.
Okay, let's get to that debate in a moment. I just want to press you on this further. Are you arguing that the central argument against the death penalty is that you might execute innocent people, or do you also object to the use of the death penalty when you believe the person is guilty?
Well, the Innocence Project does not come out as an abolitionist group. What we're simply saying is, since we have now seen so many different exonerations in non-capital cases as well as capital cases, you know, just in DNA alone, we're up to 316 wrongful convictions proven innocent by DNA post-conviction, that the vulnerability of the criminal justice system is so obvious, so apparent, that how can you have a sentence which is irreversible, particularly given the likelihood that innocent people could be executed? It makes much more sense morally and ethically to have a sentence of life without parole, where people can't get out, where they're seriously punished. But if it turns out one day that they're actually innocent and somebody else committed the crime, we can reverse that injustice.
All right. John Malcolm, I want to play for you a moment. The stepmother of Clayton Lockett, LaDonna Holmes, she's the stepmother of the man who died in that execution last week, and she spoke to Oklahoma's News 6 saying that the state's execution was inhumane.
I know it was to put him to death, but not to torture him. He did a bad thing. We recognized that. We all did. But it's a constitutional wrong.
So she's not arguing that he shouldn't be executed, but that he shouldn't be tortured. And the Constitution does create a prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Do you think the death penalty should be frozen in this country until they figure out how to do it right?
No, I don't believe that. I mean, look, what happened to Clayton Lockett shouldn't happen. Oklahoma should look in to the circumstances to find out exactly what happened. It's unclear at this point, for instance, whether there was a problem with the three-drug cocktail that was used or whether the problem was an improper placement of the needle in Mr. Lockett's vein. They should surely do what they can to make sure that the execution, future executions, are carried out as swiftly and humanely as possible. But no, I mean, there are lots of states that have had no problems executing people. You know, in fact, your first caller or your first speaker, Devlin Barrett, said, look, there are simpler ways to kill people than a three-drug cocktail, and those should be implemented. You know, I'd also note, just briefly responding to something Peter Neufeld said. He said, look, he believes it's most likely that we've already executed an innocent person. He does that on the basis of exonerations in some capital cases and in non-capital cases. There are a lot of abolitionist groups out there that are looking for that holy grail, if you will, of trying to prove definitively that we have, in fact, executed an innocent person. Now, I have no crystal ball, but I can tell you that they have yet to come up with that person.
As you can imagine, gentlemen, we're getting a lot of calls on this topic. I'd like to listen to Abby, who's calling from Winchester, Virginia. Abby, hi, you're on. What's your comment?
Well, hi, Jessica. I just don't understand why we're even discussing this. This guy killed people. What about his victim? What about the pain they went through? He was going to die regardless. Who cares how he died? He killed people, and they were in pain as well. Why are we not even talking about his victims? What he did to them was inhumane. I don't care how he dies. Why are we even wasting our time discussing this?
Abby, thank you for the call. As we noted earlier, he did kill a young woman, 19-year-old Stephanie Niemann. And I want to ask John this question. Should we be caring how he died? And is part of the purpose of the death penalty to make these convicts suffer?
I don't think so. I understand why people feel that way. And look, any discussion about the death penalty shouldn't be antiseptic. I'm very pleased that you had your previous guest describe the circumstances of Clayton Lockett's murder. Charles Warner, by the way, the guy whose execution has been temporarily put on hold, he raped and murdered the 11-month-old child of his girlfriend. So this should not be antiseptic. These people commit horrific crimes, but you know, I believe that this should be the death penalty should be carried out soberly and with reflection and in the most humane way possible. But I understand the instincts of your caller who feels that you know a just punishment would be involving one in which pain is inflicted. I do believe that the death penalty is clearly constitutional. It retains public support. And there are many, many people who believe that it is the only penalty that remotely fits the crime of people like Clayton Lockett and Charles Warner.
Peter Neufeld, can you give us a brief history of the death penalty? How many states have it? Why are they all using lethal injection, or do some of them employ other means?
Well, the number of states that adopt the death penalty actually continues to decline year after year. And right now there are just 32 states that have the death penalty. Six states in the last 6 years, including New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, New Mexico, Maryland, have all gotten rid of the death penalty. And the primary reason they've gotten rid of the death penalty is they realize several things. One is that, my God, that there are innocent people on death row. You know, the same week that this execution was botched in Oklahoma, the foremost scientific agency in the United States, the National Academy of Sciences, published a study indicating that in all likelihood, approximately 4% of those people who were sentenced to death in America are actually innocent. And that's an extraordinary number. Now, some people might say, well, that just shows that 96% of the time they get it right. You know, and I ask all of you, if you knew that, let's say, airplanes in America had a 4% error rate, and that one out of every 25 planes would crash and burn, would you fly a plane? Of course not, because the risk of a failure is just too great. And when you're talking about a risk that involves a human life, it's simply too great. So the issue, you can have all kinds of discussions about whether or not you want lethal injections, whether you want to bring back hanging or the electric chair, but all those discussions miss the point. You know, the danger is just so great. And to simply say, well, somebody confessed, well, in 25% of our wrongful conviction cases, people confessed. It just turned out that the confessions were false confessions and they were actually innocent. They were either coerced into confessing or they're the kind of compliant people who confess all the time. There are all kinds of reasons. There are all kinds of people where there was overwhelming evidence of guilt. The first person to be exonerated off of death row with DNA is a guy named Kirk Bloodsworth down in Maryland. Kirk was convicted of committing the most heinous crime, the abduction, sexual assault, and murder of a little girl. Okay, there were five eyewitnesses. It turned out all five eyewitnesses were wrong, and another man was ultimately identified, and his DNA matched the DNA left in the little girl, and Kirk was exonerated. So, you know, there's such a rush to judgment. There's such a desire to seek revenge, but it may be the wrong person. And my God, the expense of it all. You know, people are realizing now that at a time when we don't have this kind of money to spend $500,000 or $1 million to make sure that we take a man's life, it just isn't worth it if you can save a lot of money and put that person away and keep him off the street for the rest of his natural life.
John,
I want to
let John get in here for
sure,
a moment.
Yeah.
I
just remember,
your passion.
Though, that, you know, that every other European country has done away with this. Most Western countries have done away with it for a whole host of reasons. So whether something is technically constitutional doesn't make it moral, doesn't make it ethical.
Okay, John.
If I may respond.
Yes, please.
Several things that Peter said worth responding to. First of all, the report that he just referred to with this 4% figure, again, it is based on extrapolations in cases in which people were exonerated. By the way, exonerated is not the same thing as being innocent, but some of them are innocent, based on extrapolations of people who were not put to death. There has been nobody who has come forward and definitively shown that an innocent person, at least since the moratorium on the death penalty was lifted in 1976, that an innocent person has been put to death. He said, Peter said, there's a rush to judgment. In capital cases, there is never a rush to judgment. There are innumerable appeals, and that is, in fact, part of what drives up the cost that he referred to. And there is an awful lot of attention, deservedly so, paid by people like Mr. Neufeld in cases in which a death penalty may be imposed. So everything is done that is conceivably possible to weed out actual innocence. I have other things
all
to
right.
say, but I know you got a commercial
break.
Well,
we've
to
got
go
a
to.
Quick break. We all have tons to discuss. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the death penalty in the United States after the botched execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma last week. With me from New York is Peter Neufeld, co-director of the Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal organization that works to exonerate wrongly convicted people. He is a longtime anti-death penalty advocate. And from Washington, John Malcolm, director of the Legal Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, before we get back into the conversation, I just want to let you know what some of our listeners are saying online. Sean writes, when someone premeditates murder and gets the death penalty, what is there to argue? Maybe the method here needs some correction, but the death penalty is deserved in this case. Tiffany writes, until we can prove guilt with 100% accuracy 100% of the time, the death penalty is inherently flawed and should be abolished. We have people on both sides of the question. I want to go to you, John Malcolm, to begin our next conversation. Is there proof that the death penalty deters crime?
Well, actually, before I get to your question, which I'll get to in just a moment, I just wanted to complete a couple of thoughts before you went to break. Peter pointed out that six states have recently abolished the death penalty, and that's true. But I would note the two others, Delaware and New Hampshire, just voted to retain the death penalty. And by the way, there are still plenty of Democratic nations around the world that retain the death penalty. And in Europe, there are international organizations that put tremendous pressure on some countries to abolish the death penalty, even though the death penalty is still supported by a majority of the people in the country. Now, with respect to whether the death penalty is a deterrent, you know, there's inconclusive evidence. There are some studies, older studies from Emory and University of Houston, University of Colorado, that certainly suggest that the death penalty is a deterrent. In April of 2012, the National Research Council came out with a report that said that there's insufficient evidence to make an argument one way or the other. The evidence doesn't prove the proposition that the death penalty deters or doesn't deter homicides. I would, however, make this point, though. All of us in our everyday lives, when we go about making decisions, we all weigh the potential risks and benefits, and potential risk can include a potential penalty if you're caught, of taking certain actions. We do this all the time. It strikes me as being illogical that potential murderers are somehow the only class of people who don't go through this mental calculus when they're thinking about whether to commit a heinous crime.
Peter, let me ask you for just a moment here. I want to get to an important point in some of the statistics that President Obama brought up when he was asked about the execution in Oklahoma last week. I want you to listen to this. He mentioned that one of the series of problems with the death penalty's application is racial injustice in sentencing.
In the application of the death penalty in this country, we have seen significant problems, racial bias, an uneven application of the death penalty, situations in which there were individuals on death row who later on were discovered to have been innocent because of exculpatory evidence. And all these, I think, do raise significant questions about how the death penalty is being applied.
Now, Peter, the statistics I've seen show that black men are more than six times as likely as white men to be incarcerated. That's higher than the proportion in 1960, so all those years ago, and that blacks make up 13% of the U.S. population, but 42% of death row inmates.
Well, actually, the data is even more compelling than that. 80% of all death row defendants have been executed for killing white victims, even though in our society as a whole, African Americans account for about half of murder victims. So in other words, if the victim is white, it's much more likely that you will be executed if you commit exactly the same crime but the victim is black. At the Innocence Project, 70% of our exonerees are people of color. It's far disproportionate from what it should be. As for Mr. Malcolm's suggestion that, you know, saying logically, how could it not be deterrent? You know, well, it's not about logic or simply about one's emotional reaction. But if you look at the six states that abolished the death penalty in the last 6 years, in not one of those states did the death rate increase, the murder rate increase. And frankly, in the states that execute the most people, those are the most violent states in the nation. Those are the states that have much higher murder rates. So there really is no data that suggests a relationship to deterrence. But the racial issue is one that is extremely troubling. There are too many people who are charged simply because they are black and the alleged victim is white. You know, you can't forget that in the first half of the 20th century, black men all over, not just the South, but other states as well, were lynched. And what were they lynched for? Committing the usual crime. And by the usual crime, they meant an assault or an alleged sexual assault or even looking the wrong way at a white woman. And those attitudes still prevail in many places, and they certainly have not been eliminated from our criminal justice system.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. I want to go to the phones for a moment to talk to David, who is calling from Lexington, South Carolina. John, I promise I'll get to you, but David—
Yeah, I've got a lot to say in response to that.
David, for now, please— Hi, David. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. I worked in corrections for 18 years. And I am totally against the death penalty for a variety of reasons. I worked death row where individuals were waiting for 15 or 16 years before they were supposed to be executed. It is much more appropriate for an individual who commits a heinous crime to be put in prison for the rest of his life. It's a less expensive situation as far as the trials are concerned, and the individual is going to suffer even more in prison than it is for the revenge factor. Now, I understand the revenge factor, but I just don't see any, and there is no deterrent that I know of. I have spoken to quite a few individuals, some of which have committed some incredibly bad crimes. The idea is they're not thinking about what the consequences are when they commit these crimes. So a death penalty certainly does not in any way, shape, or form, from what I know of, and I'm talking about 18 years here, from what I know of, has ever stopped an individual from doing what they want to do in the way of a crime. Most people who commit crimes, who are career criminals, have non-reflective personalities anyway. They're not thinking about what the consequences are.
David, fabulous to hear from somebody who has really been there and seen this. Interesting point of view. Thank you for calling. John, I want you to respond to it, but before we get there, I'd like to remind everybody that there are victims in all of this. And Mark Class, everyone might remember, his 12-year-old daughter was raped and murdered in 1993. The convicted murderer in his daughter's case is currently on death row. And Class was asked about the execution last week of Clayton Lockett. He spoke to ABC News' This Week on Sunday with little sympathy for Clayton Lockett.
This isn't about Clayton Lockett. This isn't about his victimization. This is about a heinous and unforgiving criminal act that he committed against an innocent young woman.
So, John, you hear the emotion there. You heard the logical explanation from a corrections officer who has worked death row. Your response?
Yeah, well, I'd love actually to have a conversation offline with that corrections officer. He says that, you know, people suffer a lot more by spending their lives in prison, the rest of their lives in prison, as opposed to being, you know, executed. Obviously, the people in that position don't feel that way, since they are all trying mightily to have their death sentences converted into life imprisonment. You don't see anybody with a sentence of life imprisonment who is, struggling mightily to have the death penalty imposed. I would like to get to the point about race. In terms of the death penalty, it's an important issue, and I'd of course like to begin by saying that, look, racism of any kind in our criminal justice system is wrong, and we should work hard to eliminate it whenever and wherever it occurs. You pointed out that in proportion to their percentage of our population, that African Americans are, you know, receive the death penalty at a higher proportion. However, I would also note that, you know, unfortunately, over 50%, at least that's what it was the last time I looked at the statistics, of people who are charged with murder in this country are African American. And so when you look at the percentage of people who receive the death penalty compared to the number of people who, or percentage of people who are charged with murder, that tells a very different story. Now, Peter pointed out about, you know, people who, African-American people who kill white people are more likely to receive the death penalty. I would first of all note that every study, even by death penalty abolitionists, has conceded that there is no racial bias based on the race of the defendant. I would note that most murders in this country are intra-racial. It's African-Americans killing African-Americans and whites killing whites. They often involve crimes of passion or somebody who knows the victim. The death penalty is often imposed in inter-racial murders, where somebody does something in the process of committing another heinous felony, an armed robbery, a rape, et cetera. And there, unfortunately, there are more black-on-white crimes committed than there are white-on-black crimes. So I think it's important to sort of keep those statistics in mind when evaluating the very sensitive issue.
John, there's also the possibility then that the way those crimes are tracked down, the police are, you know, because of whatever inherent assumptions that are made, that black crimes are somehow prosecuted more aggressively than white crimes, no?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I would note this, that a lot of the black-on-white crimes take place in rural areas and that prosecutors and citizens in rural areas tend to be more supportive of the death penalty than heinous crimes committed in urban areas. The one demographic that has consistently been against the imposition of the ultimate punishment are African Americans. And, you know, DAs are elected legislators who have to respond to the needs of their citizens. So there are a lot of factors that are involved. It's not, you know, as simple an issue as perhaps Peter portrayed, in my view.
Well, Jessica,
Peter,
I'd like briefly respond on that. Just
if you can
briefly.
Keep it brief, because I want to get to a couple other
I
points.
I will. Okay, but he's simply missing the gross amount of data which demonstrates racial disparity here. He pointed out that most crimes occur intra-race, black on black, white on white, and boy, is that true with respect to rape and rape murder. Only about 12% of all sexual assault crimes are cross-racial. So you would expect that in our exonerations, only about 12% of our exonerations would be cross-racial. In fact, more than 50% of the time, black men are wrongly convicted in our database of sexually assaulting or sexually assaulting and murdering white women. That's four times higher than what it should be. And in each of those cases, it's more likely that those black men will not only have prosecutorial misconduct present, snitches who are lying, false confessions, police misconduct, all the causes of wrongful conviction are much more pronounced whenever it's a black man sitting in the docket and the alleged victim is white.
Okay. I'd like to go to Peter, who's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Jessica. First of all, we should keep the death penalty, and it should be done by the states as they wish. Next, President Obama should stop meddling in the state's affairs. He has far more important things to do. Third, who cares what the Europeans think or do? This is America. They run their country. We run ours. Fourth, blacks commit a disproportionate amount of crime when they are convicted of capital crimes. They should be executed, as should whites. Finally, we have far more serious things to talk about than a botched execution in Oklahoma. This has wasted far too much time and too much space. Thank you.
Peter, thank you for your call. To Peter Neufeld, I imagine you, as many other people, disagree with him. Many agree, but many think that it is an important issue to discuss because it goes to what our values are as a country, which leads me to a question I really want you to answer. Does the Oklahoma execution raise the specter of the Supreme Court revisiting the constitutionality of the lethal injection?
I don't see that from this court. And that may be actually the one issue that John Malcolm and I agree on. I don't think this court is going to interfere in that. You know, you have to remember that by most objective standards, this is the most conservative Supreme Court since 1920. And in issues like this, they've generally come out on the much more conservative side. One last point, though, I did want to make is, you know, John talked about, well, finding innocent people. And I just want to mention to your listeners that we've tried to do that a number of times. On a couple of occasions, we tried to get DNA testing before they executed the individual, particularly in Texas. And we were told they wouldn't wait and do the DNA testing, but we could do the DNA testing after the execution. Go figure. Nevertheless, when we then went back and asked for DNA testing, they said they had changed their minds. Despite that kind of opposition, I think we've already demonstrated that the execution in Texas of Cameron Todd Willingham for arson was actually of an innocent person, that there's overwhelming evidence to support that conclusion. There's a new book that your listeners should read by James Lieberman, a professor at Columbia University, about the case of Carlos de Luna, who he also proves was in all likelihood innocent. Nevertheless, he was executed. Those books, those stories should be read by your listeners, and they will see that executions of innocent people do happen.
May I respond briefly to that, Jessica?
Sure. And if you could also tell me, do you think that states should be in charge of overseeing the death penalty? Should they reconsider the firing squad, other means of execution?
Sure. Cameron Todd Willingham confessed to his ex-wife, whom he cursed as his final words, that he had committed the murder in question. He also gave investigators four different stories about the how the fire got started, which was an arson that killed his children. Even his lawyer admitted that he was guilty. The Carlos de Luna, there are too many facts to get involved for me to mention on the air. However, it was by no means clear that Carlos de Luna was innocent of the crime that he was charged with and ultimately executed for. In terms of, you know, what states are going to do, there are a number of alternative methods of execution available. You know, eight states allow for electrocution, three states allow for the gas chamber, three states still allow hanging, two states have a firing squad. Those are all secondary methods to lethal injection, but there are states that are going to go back and look at this, and in terms of the firing squad, far less of a risk of error, no indication of pain, and death is practically instantaneous.
This was a great discussion, gentlemen. Thank you for being with us. Peter Neufeld, co-director of the Innocence Project. Peter, thank you. And John Malcolm, director of the Legal Study Center at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you to you as well. And you all can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, deadly clashes and downed helicopters. We'll look at the latest in Ukraine and what can, should the U.S. and NATO do. I'm Jessica Yellen. This is On Point.